Before I get to the subject of this afternoon's lecture, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, I wanted to make a couple of additional points on Locke. I didn't discuss, I said a good deal about Locke's second treatise on government, but I didn't say anything about the first treatise on government, which is practically no one ever reads that. Now, what happened, that the first treatise on government was a reply to a work called Patriarcha by Sir Robert Filmer, who was a defender of absolute monarchy. It was quite popular with the supporters of Charles I. And he had died, I think, in the 1650s, but his book was reissued by some of the people who supported Charles II, who supported a very strong role for the king. I should say one reason Locke issued, when he issued the two treatises, it was anonymous. He didn't, although a lot of people knew he wrote the book, he never acknowledged this, even until he died, he never acknowledged being the author. And one reason for this was Algernon Sidney also wrote an attack on Filmer, and he was executed, although not for that reason. So in those days, if you wanted to write an attack on Sir Robert Filmer, you had to be pretty careful about it. So what Filmer's contention was that the reason the king had authority was that originally, when God created the world, Adam had governmental authority. The first man had governmental authority, and he passed this on to his descendants through the line of Seth. And then this was passed on and on down to the currently existing kings. Now, Filmer Filmer denied Aristotle's contention that some people were slaves by nature. He didn't hold that, but he thought that just because of his historical argument, also the argument that fathers have authority in their family and that political power is like that, so it's passed on to the present kings. Almost no one thinks Filmer's argument is any good. The only person I think of an exception to that, my late friend Mel Bradford, University of Dallas, once wrote an article. It was in a Festschrift for Frederick Wilhelmsen, saying that he thought Filmer had the better of the argument, but most people don't think so. So Locke, in his very long first treatise, denied all of Filmer's contentions. Said no, first of all, we have no reason to think that any of the present kings, they can't show any direct descent from Adam. And even if they could, it wouldn't make any difference because we have no reason to think political power passed in that way. We don't have Adam's authority in the family was nothing like that of a political ruler. Family rule and political ruler, completely different things. And then there's also some question of what was the authority of Adam in his own family? What was the authority of the husband and the father in the family? I mentioned that last time. And the other point I wanted to make about Locke, in the question period, Roderick Long raised the very interesting point that Locke says not only that we surrender to the community, our right to enforce the law of nature, but we also surrender as much of our liberty as is needed to preserve the rest. So the question comes up, does this give supporters of a stronger, non-limited government some Lockean argument for restricting liberty? They could say, well, we're just, people have given up as much liberty as they need to preserve the rest. Now, it seems to me this passage is more plausibly interpreted this way. If you give up your right to enforce the law of nature, it might be the case in the state of nature, you would have chosen particular instances not to enforce the law of nature at all. Say somebody's, you see somebody, say, assaulting somebody else, and you decide you're just going to pass by. It's, don't want to get involved. And it could turn out that if the government now has this role of enforcing law of nature, they could, in for pursuit of defense, say, require you to help them out, or say there's an invasion, they might require you to bear arms and defend the country. So I think this is when it said to preserve the rest, what it's meant here is something like ancillary to enforcing the law of nature. It's supplementary to this, rather than meaning that the government can simply rearrange people's rights in order somehow to maximize liberty. If they say to, if it's said to preserve the rest, that suggests, at least to me, that there's a pre-existing pattern of rights, and what the government is doing is supposed to be doing is preserve that as much as possible, say, from invasions. And that said, we can now turn to Rousseau, who lived from 1712 to 1778. Rousseau was born in Geneva, which was an independent city-state in Switzerland. The states were joined in some kind of loose confederation, but really, Geneva, they were really largely self-governed at that time. And Rousseau attached a lot of importance to the fact that he was born in Geneva. He thought that he remembered when he was growing up, he had memories of festivals in which all the people would join in and for patriotic celebration. There would be music and dancing, and he thought this was extremely important, and he thought this should be recreated as much as possible. And in the Social Contract and elsewhere, he talks about the need to have public festivals and have music that would, he attached great deal of importance to music, having the proper music to educate the people in proper habits. He himself at one point had lost his citizenship, his Genevan citizenship, because he converted to Catholicism, and Catholics weren't allowed to be citizens of Geneva, but then he renounced Catholicism and he regained his citizenship. But I think he continued to sign himself as a citizen of Geneva even when he was, sometimes when he was no longer entitled to call himself that. That is so minor thing as legal propriety would not stop Rousseau from doing what he wanted. In his youth, somehow became involved with a Swiss convert to Catholicism named Madame de Warenne. She encouraged him to convert to Catholicism, and I think it was because of her that he did so, and he became very attached to her. He viewed her as a mother figure. He had somewhat of a fixation on her that lasted all his life. And for a brief period, they were romantically involved, although this is one of the most happiest days of his life was when he was with her, but then he came back from a journey and he found out she replaced him with a younger man. She tended to do that, and then he had to leave and go elsewhere. He made his way to Paris, and he became friends with some of the leading French intellectuals, including Denise Diderot and Voltaire and D'Alembert, some of the leading figures of the French Enlightenment. He was later to quarrel bitterly with Voltaire, and he had developed very serious differences with some of these Enlightenment figures. But on Diderot had been imprisoned for although under very good conditions in a chateau in the countryside for writing some material that was considered inflammatory. Rousseau describes he was on a visit to Diderot and he rested a while and he said he was overcome by a vision and he said he could never write what he had learned in that vision. He wished he could express even a part of what he had gotten in that vision. This vision, 1749, was rather formative, was formative for his later works. He wrote shortly thereafter two important works, the Discourse on the Arts and Sciences and the Discourse on Inequality, that I'll be talking about in a short while, but I just want to first just give a sort of narrative of his life. So after he wrote those essays, he was also, his main work was, his profession was, he was a music copyist. He earned most of his income copying music, and he developed a new system of musical notation, which wasn't very successful, but he had greater success. He was a popular composer of operas, one of which the King Louis XV liked very much, and he besides composing operas, he also wrote one of the most popular novels, the Nouvelle Heloise, which was a bestseller for its time. And so while he was doing, besides this, he continued his work as a political theorist, including writing his most famous work, which is the one I'll be talking about most, The Social Contract, which came out in 1762. He continued all sorts of literary works, including his famous Confessions and his last work, The Reveries of a Solitary Walker. He was an extremely productive writer, and if that wasn't enough, he was also a botanist, one of the best botanists of his time, and he collected all sorts of plants and wrote about them. He was one of the best observers and recorders of nature of his time. So he was, although, as I hope to show, he had some, from a libertarian point of view, very wrong-headed ideas, he was an extremely talented writer. He was also, he had quite a few personality quirks. If followers of Thomas Sowers will forgive me, he was rather definitely paranoid, at least at some points in his life. He thought there was a conspiracy of nearly everyone, including people who claimed to be his friends, to destroy his reputation. And this led, one time he had been befriended by the great Scottish philosopher David Hume, and he visited Hume, but he quarreled with Hume, and then he considered Hume as somebody who was trying to destroy him also. He didn't have a very conventional family life. He married a serving woman named Thérèse Levasseur and had five children with her, but he gave them all up to a foundling hospital. He didn't raise any of his children himself. So, although he sometimes wrote in his books about the benefits of family affection, it wasn't something he practiced in his own life. If we look at Rousseau's thought, I think one of the key themes is that he rejected a basic principle of economics, or at least not if he at least to a large extent rejected it. And the principle is one that, if you're familiar with the works of Murray Rothbard, has developed this extensively, is the benefits of the division of labor. Supposing we all had to produce everything we needed for ourselves, we wouldn't be able to get anywhere. Imagine you had to produce all your own food or grow everything for yourself. Very few people would be able, the earth couldn't support very many people, and people would have to live their lives on a very poor basis. You'd be spending all your time just trying to stay alive. You wouldn't be able without just on your own, say if you got sick, you wouldn't be able to go to a doctor and get any medication. You would just have to rely on your own devices to cure yourself. You wouldn't be able to rely on any police agencies to protect you. You'd have to do everything by yourself. This wouldn't be a very good state to be in. We would clearly want to say, with Hobbes, even if we didn't agree with him on what the state of nature like, would clearly be solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. We wouldn't want to be in this. But Rousseau didn't agree with this at all. You remember in the two discourses I mentioned, discourses on inequality, discourse on arts and sciences, he thought quite the contrary, that when primitive man had not developed the division of labor, then people were much happier. It wasn't that because we have a division of labor, we're able to get all sorts of goods and services we couldn't get if we were just by our own, that this makes us all better off. Rousseau said, no, this isn't right. Now, how could he have said that? Well, he said, first of all, it's true that if you have a division of labor, you can get all sorts of things you couldn't get before. But when this happens, people have, along with the extra goods, they develop all sorts of extra desires that they didn't have before. So it turns out that you can have more things available to you, but you always keep wanting more and more. So you're not really any better off. You're worse off, because it turns out in the primitive state, you're not getting very much, but you're satisfied. You know that's pretty much all there's available. But in the division of labor, more modern world, you know there are all sorts of things available that you can't have that you want, so this makes you feel very bad. Even worse, supposing before you have a division of labor, people are, even if they find it hard to produce things for themselves, they're not dependent on anyone else. But in the more developed economy, you are dependent on other people. If I had to rely on people, if I couldn't rely on other people, I wouldn't be able to eat anything. Since I don't have any of the agricultural tools available to grow my own food. If other people don't give me anything, then I'm out of things. I'm completely dependent on other people. Now, the dependence here isn't only economic. It isn't only that if other people don't give me these goods that I need, then I'm not going to survive. There's also a psychological dependence. Now, Rousseau thought that everyone has a certain amount of self-love. Everyone cares about himself. He calls this amour de soi. But he says once we have people who aren't self-sufficient, people who are dependent on others, then people are very much dependent on how other people view them. People say your self-esteem depends very much on whether other people think well of you. So people have what he calls amour propre. They're concerned with their reputation. Now, you say, well, what's wrong with this? Well, Rousseau thought this makes people two-faced because they'll do what they think will be required to get other people to like them, but this won't reflect their true personality. So the developed economy, division of labor, really makes people worse off because it makes them deceptive. They become, as I say, two-faced. People are necessarily insincere. People are no longer transparent to each other because people have inner motives that others are unable to discern. So you would know, even if someone has a certain appearance, you would think to yourself, well, is the person really like that? You would say the other person might be trying to deceive me, so I can't really trust him. So people become mistrustful of each other in this situation. There's this feeling that you don't really know what other people are like. There's a very good book on this theme by Jean Starobinsky. I think it's on the theme of transparency in Rousseau. In particular, what's the feature, what enables this state of affairs, I say, where we have division of labor to develop and where people are insincere and they're not transparent to each other, is what enables us to develop is individual property. If we, in the primitive state of affairs, people just used what was available as they needed it, but they didn't claim the right to exclude others. So Rousseau says, whoever first fenced off an area and said, this is mine, was a great criminal, because by doing so, he set in motion this whole process of division of labor and developed economy in which people are become much worse off. They're no longer transparent, they're insincere, and they're dependent on each other. That's the bad side. Now let's say a bit more about how Rousseau thought human beings began. As Rousseau saw matter, when human beings first arose, people really were largely solitary. They came together occasionally for a purpose of reproduction. You would have perhaps small groups of people would live together, but people were largely solitary, so they weren't dependent on other people. They weren't at all dependent on other people. People were not hostile to each other. On the contrary, people had a feeling of compassion for each other. They would, if they saw someone suffering, their tendency would be to help them out. People were basically compassionate. So human beings were really good, but they didn't have any developed consciousness. And they lived by hunting or fishing, sometimes cultivating small areas. It didn't really require much effort for them to live. So it was, they in Rousseau's opinion, they were very happy. Now, it's interesting, of course, what Rousseau was saying was completely speculative, but there are cultural anthropologists who think this view that he had was pretty largely correct. There's one, Marshall Solins, who has argued that this is a correct picture thing, although it may be that he holds this view. Oh, did I? There I go again. Yeah, people shouldn't read him anyway. So, not really worth it. But maybe maybe Solins holds this view just because he's a disciple of Rousseau, so we can't really say, I'm not really sure that what he says can be taken as evidence Rousseau is right. It might just be show he has Rousseauian predilections. Now, one thing, though, also is true about human beings in this primitive state is they didn't have very developed consciousness. There wasn't much going on mentally then. That was what, that's perfectly all right with Rousseau because that made them even happier. There was a famous essay by Arthur Lovejoy, who was a great intellectual historian, who said that you can't really say that the primitive people that Rousseau described, they aren't really human beings at all. We can take it as some sort of evolution. We can take it kind of as an evolutionary stage in which it could be perhaps some higher anthropoids were in that state. Now, what ruined this idyllic state? Rousseau thought that population had gotten out of hand. People reproduced too much to maintain this kind of life where people could just, say, hunt and just get what they need to live fairly easily. If you had more people around, they couldn't maintain themselves in such a lifestyle. So this required a more organized life. Things were all right for a while until property came on the scene, and then that ruined things. Now, you might think from this that Rousseau, given that he had this view, would say, well, what we have to do is get rid of the arts and sciences and try to go back to this primitive stage. Then we could all be happy. But he didn't. That wasn't his view at all. I mean, that wouldn't really be a very sensible view. First of all, that state of affairs, even if Rousseau is right about that people would be happier living in that state of affairs, that could support only very few people. So we'd have to get rid of nearly everybody if we wanted to try to go back to that. Furthermore, once we've gotten out of that state, we wouldn't be able to recreate this primitive kind of mentality, that the innocence that people had then couldn't be regained. So we're pretty much stuck with the human mentality the way it is as we have it. So what Rousseau said was, is there something we can do, as he says in Social Contract, taking men as they are, but laws as they could be? So his aim wasn't to change people back to some primitive state, but he was saying, given that we have human beings in a certain way, how can we make things better? How can we remedy these defects of the modern world where people are dominated by amour propre, they're dominated by their need to put on appearances for each other, that they can't be sincere, they're dependent on each other. So as Rousseau says at the beginning of Social Contract, man is born free, but he's everywhere in chains. And what he wants to do is, he wants to come up, he says, can he justify the transition that people have gotten into in getting into civilized life? And he says, if we could do this, what we would be doing, could we come up with some way in which people would be create a government which they would be giving up certain their liberties, their liberties to the government, but each one would be as free as he was before once he'd given up these things. So again, Rousseau surprised expectations. You would think, well, if people want to try to be as free as possible, they would want to give up as little liberty as possible to the government. I shouldn't say to the government, to the, because as it turns out, it's what the government has a very special meaning in Rousseau's work. So what we're really giving it up, is to the common will, what he calls in the book the general will. But you would think that Rousseau would say we want to give up as little of our liberty as possible. But Rousseau, again, is a very paradoxical writer. He surprises expectations. He said, well, no, what he claims to have to come up with, the way which each person will give up everything to this body, this entity, the general will, and in return will be find that he's as free as before. So this is, Rousseau has set himself a very tall order, saying each of us can give up everything, but we'll still be free once we do it. And then the question is, will he be successful in this very daring enterprise? I'll let you in on the result. He isn't. All right. What he does, it first of all, before he gets to his own views on the proper, the general will, he refutes attacks earlier theories of the origin of the state. Now, he tends a bit to fall into, perhaps into this fallacy. He'll say there are so and so many views possible of the origin of the state, A, B, C, and D. I've shown that A, B, and C are all wrong. That leaves D, which is my view. And so we should accept that one. And this isn't such a good way of arguing, because first of all, he would have to show that all those alternatives, are exhausted. There couldn't be other alternatives. But even if those are the alternatives, it could turn out that all the theories are wrong. Who says we have to have a satisfactory theory of the origins of state authority? It could turn out they're all wrong. So the fact, if it is a fact that he's successful in refuting some of the theories, doesn't show that his view is correct. One of the views he attacks is one that I mentioned before in connection with Locke, one held by Filmer, that power comes out of it, the political power comes from the human family. Just as the father has authority in the family, the political ruler has authority, somewhat like a father over his people. But Rousseau makes short work of this theory in arguments similar to Locke. He was very familiar with Locke and also with Hobbes and practically everybody, all the classical authors. He was a very well-read writer. He just said, well, no, just as Locke had done, the political authority isn't at all like that of the family. The father of a family is motivated by affection for his children, and then his authority lapses after the children become adults. And this is nothing like the situation in conventional politics, where the government isn't motivated by affection for the people. He mentions also the theory held by Hobbes that people are in such a bad state of affairs, in this state without government, people are constantly at war with each other, people are hostile to each other, that they set up a government to get out of this bad state of affairs. But he said, This is wrong because it assumes that there's some kind of constant human nature that make people at odds with each other. And in fact, what people's nature is as far as their hostility to others or how peaceful are very much depends on the social conditions. So people might be that way at certain, in certain historical periods, but that's not a constant that explains the, explains why people, that, why government exists, because people need not be like this. I should say, as usual, there's a, Straussian view, which says, as you might expect, Rousseau is, like Locke, a secret Hobbesian, and, he really does hold that the state of nature is pretty Hobbesian. Even if people don't have to be in that state, they pretty much are in that state of the Hobbesian state of nature. And so this does explain what, government, how government comes about. There's a very good Straussian author on Rousseau, Hillel Gildan. Who has a book on the social contract where he gives this view. Now, another view that Rousseau gives is, he says, here he mentions Grotius. Grotius just appealed to various historical events, especially described in the Bible, on how, say, people had been had been captured in war and had, in order not to be killed, had accepted the rule of their conquerors. So Rousseau said the problem with Grotius is he has no distinction between what happened and what should happen. He just accepts whatever happened in the past as valid. He doesn't say, is this the right thing to do or not? He just said, well, I have some historical precedents that such and such happened, so this gives a basis for government. That isn't a good way of doing things. Now, what Rousseau argued it was we should explain the origins of the state in this way. We imagine a group of people in everyone surrenders all his rights and liberties to everyone else. So it's somewhat a bit like the community in Locke's system, except you surrender not just your right to enforce the law of nature, but you surrender everything to the community. But the community then decides everything by everyone having the same will. So everyone is as free as before because the community is all sort of acts as one. And so you end up with each person having, not having rights and liberties, but he's better off than he was before because in the state of nature, he had no way of ensuring that he'd have any rights and liberties protected. But if you have everyone is unified in one entity and they all act together, they all have a unified will, Rousseau calls it the general will, volonté générale. So if you have sort of everyone acting together is a unified will, then no one is subject to anybody else. Everyone is, so we have, Rousseau gets what he wants because everyone has surrendered everything to the general will, but you're as free as you were before because you're all acting, you all have the same will, so you all want the same thing, and you're as free as you're, as you were before. Now, the difficulty here is Why would it be the case that everybody has the same will? Why would everybody will the same thing? Doesn't seem very plausible that everybody has the will to do the identical thing all the time. So how can Rousseau say this? Well, he says what you imagine is it isn't say that everybody decides we all have the same preferences in food or we all want the same kind of house. It's that what the general will does is limited to general laws. All it can do is pass laws that don't refer to any particular person by name or description. They just pass certain general regulations. And everyone wants these general regulations. So this is how you achieve the unanimity. Now, to some extent, this reduces the problem because it isn't that we have to get people agreeing on absolutely everything. So we now have people have to agree just on these general laws. But it seems, doesn't the problem just come back? Why should we think that everyone would agree on the general laws? Well, here Rousseau says this. He says, you have to get people in the right frame of mind for this agreement. Specifically, you can't have people getting together in factions, because if you could have, say, interested groups, and then they wouldn't be voting what would be in the interests of all. You just have to imagine there are no groups or factions. Each person then votes just separately on what he thinks would be in the general interest. So in that way, we will get everybody voting the same way in that, if you say, well, that's ridiculous, people still have differences of opinion. Rousseau thinks somehow the personal differences will cancel out. Say one person might think, make a mistake, but this will be balanced by somebody else making a mistake in some other direction. And what will result if everybody votes separately will be the general will, which will be a correct statement of what will be in everyone's interest. Now, there still seems to be a problem, though, is that supposing what Rousseau says is right, then the result will be the correct general law in everybody's interest. But it doesn't follow that everybody has supported that. What about the people who didn't? What if it just turns out that, say, there's a majority who supports doing things one way, some other people vote the other way. So we say, well, the general will is to do such and such. What about the people who voted the other way? So remember, Rousseau's argument is if everybody has this votes the same way, everybody wants the same thing, so we're as free as we were before because we're all doing what we want, namely this same thing. We're better off, but because we're now protected by the whole social order. We're not just dependent on ourselves to secure our liberties. We have the whole social order behind us. But as I say, how does he then get around the problem? This works, if it does work, only if everybody votes the same way, everybody wants the same way. Well, he says, if it turns out that after the vote, what you wanted isn't the way the general will turns out, what the majority voted, then what you wanted isn't what you really wanted. What you really wanted is what the general will wanted. So the general will can make you do what the decision of the majority, because this is what you really want, even though you don't think so, but you really do want this. So as Rousseau says, you can be forced to be free by doing this. Now, I want to It sounds like a ridiculous view. And I want to, though, ask, can we say anything in favor of it? I mean, after all, Rousseau, whatever one may think of him, was certainly not a stupid person. He was extraordinarily intelligent. How could he have thought that? I want to, there was mention, two arguments that have been given, I think, by philosophers, I think, are interesting to look at in this connection. One was by a philosopher I mentioned in an earlier lecture when I was discussing Plato's Republic, the Oxford philosopher H.A. Pritchard. And he had an essay where he discusses this general will argument. It was in a discussion of T.H. Green's lectures on principles of political obligation. Now, he took the a general will, or what's called a real will argument, to go something like this. We want to say people find a conflict between the right thing to do, what's the moral thing to do, and what's in their interest. This would say, as we have said in the case, suppose we think that what the general will does is the right course of action, and we say what the individual who's voting in the minority again wants to act in his own interest. So how can we reconcile self-interest with morality? How can it be the case that if I act in my own interest, I'm always acting in accord with morality? So Pritchard said, well, sometimes it sometimes turns out that morality, at least in the surface, requires us to act against our own interests. So the way then we can reconcile the two, according to Pritchard, people in the Rousseauian tradition, such as T.H. Green, have done this, is say self-interest and morality are identical, because really people should be taken as ultimately identical. People, we appear to have different bodies, but we're really all the same person. So this is one way, I think, of understanding Rousseau's contention. He's saying people in the society really become unified into one entity, one sort of collective mind. And if, say, a physical individual finds himself at variance with what the general will has decided, he's not, it isn't, and the general will requires him to do what it wants, it isn't really, general will really isn't restricting him, it's just sort of requiring kind of a subordinate part of a single entity to act in accord with the whole entity. So if you take, one way to make sense of Rousseau is to take him in this very collectivistic way. But I don't think, I hope you would agree with me, this isn't a very plausible view. Why should we think that all of us or all people in a society form part of a single entity in this way? Now, there's a better argument for a general will, a real will position. It's found in a chapter in a book by the idealist philosopher Bran Blanchard called Reason and Goodness. I'm going to say a bit about this because I think this is the most plausible argument I found for this position. Blanchard says, well, we all want to do what's rational, and we all want to do what's good. Let's assume, just for this argument, that there's no rationality and goodness lead to the same thing. So we all want what's rational. So supposing what's rational turns out to be what the general will dictates. So we say the result is we all want what the general will dictates. So in that sense, we all have the same will. We all want what the general will wants, simply because we all want to be rational, and what being rational is what the general will wants. So we all have the same will. namely to do what is rationally required. Now, I think this is, as I say, I think it's a more interesting argument than the one Pritchard ascribes to Green and Rousseau, because he Pritchard is a very negative critic of theirs. He doesn't favor the general will doctrine at all. And Blanchard is an advocate of it. He's trying to put in best the light as possible. I think we can see Blanchard's argument doesn't work. Let me just put this down this way. I think we can take the basic argument that Blanchard is suggesting, the one that the way of interpreting Rousseau is saying, people want to be rational, people want to do the right thing, say, I want to be rational, so I find out rationality requires me to do X, in this case, to do what the general will says, so therefore I want to do what the general will says. Now, this argument is formally valid, but it could turn out that when I find out that rationality requires X, it could be that that would induce me to drop the first premise. It could be when I find out, rationality is going to require me to do this, like to enlist in the armed forces, defend Geneva from a impending French invasion. Maybe I'd say, oh, I don't want to do that. Let's forget about rationality for a while. It's too hard on me. So it doesn't follow that once you see what rationality is required, that you're going to go along with it. Furthermore, supposing you did accept the argument, there would still be a very definite sense in which you wouldn't be doing what you wanted. Namely, even if you say, well, it's some kind of your conscious desires don't reflect your real self, still you do have this desire not to do what the general will says. You voted the other way. So at least in some sense, you don't want to do what the general will says, and it's merely playing with words to say that you really do, at least in a sense in which it's, if you say you want something, it's not the case that you don't want it. You can't say that here. Even if this argument worked, which I don't think it does, it would then just be the case in one sense you want what the general will says, in another sense you don't, but you wouldn't have a clear sense in which you, since you want it, you're just doing freely what you want in doing what the general will says. One wonders, having thought about this, how could Rousseau have made the claim that each person, by surrendering to the general will, is just as free as he was before? Seems like this claim doesn't get him very far. And I think we could see two things that could explain how Rousseau could have fallen into, well, one thing would explain how he could have fallen into fallacy, and I think another thing makes the claim less surprising than we might think. If we say, well, how could Rousseau have possibly thought that people are free under the conditions he set out? Because after all, you could end up not, say you turned out, you kept being outvoted, you could turn out, you'd be free in the Rousseauian sense, even if you never, practically never got to do what you wanted. You always lose the votes. Well, Rousseau, remember when he was talking about what's wrong with the developed economy, why we like the primitive, why like the primitive state fares better, he was concerned with people being dependent on others. And what he had in mind was, you're dependent on particular other people. So here, it isn't that you're dependent on any one person or other. It's just you're dependent on everybody. You're dependent on the whole social body of which you're a constituent part. You have an equal part to everybody else. So somehow, I think this is the fallacy, a key fallacy in Rousseau's argument. He thought somehow this meant you weren't dependent because you're not dependent on a particular person. You're just dependent on the social body. And I think we can see the same fallacy in many political proposals today. For example, sometimes people defend conscription, forcing people to enlist in the army, by saying this is democratically voted, as if somehow if the fact that it isn't that a particular dictator is telling you have to be in the army, it's that there's somehow a vote for it in which you had one of the votes that go into the conscription law. Somehow this means that you're free because it isn't a particular person ordering you to do this. And I think this is certainly not a correct view of freedom to adopt. You're just as involuntarily in the army if you don't want to be there as if you're there because of a vote than if you were there because you got orders from some king or dictator. I remember there was a letter I once saw by the political theorist Benjamin Barber, who very much likes the Swiss style of collective decision-making. He defended conscription. So somebody wrote in and said, it was, I think, in Dissent magazine, which is a socialist periodical, somebody said, conscription is really a form of slavery. And he got very upset. He said, oh, how can you possibly say this? This is just the kind of thinking we have to get away from, as if, you know, once there had been a democratic vote for something that settled the question. Now, I said that was I think is a fallacy. That falling into that fallacy could account for Rousseau's line of thought, why he thought that, how could he say that people are free even if turns out they're not doing what they want. Now, I think another thing that could mitigate the enormity of Rousseau's claim is, remember, what he's saying is that people will find that they're as free as they were before getting into this. They surrendered to everything to general will. But then we have to ask, well, how free were they before? It could turn out they're not very free before, say, if they were in something like they couldn't, by hypothesis, really protect their rights in the state affairs before the general will. So they're not really free, really very free to begin with. So if they're no more free than they're as free as they were before, it isn't perhaps that much of a claim. That would be, if Rousseau said that, I think he would be being rather tricky. So maybe he was a secret, the Straussians are right after all. I mean, if you took him this way, he wouldn't really, in saying that people would be as free as before, he wouldn't really be making a very strong claim. And I said we have to distinguish, when I said I first talked about setting up the government, but I said I shouldn't really say government because this is a special term in Rousseau's thinking. Now, Rousseau didn't call the entity that constituted by the general will, didn't call that the government. The general will just handles, makes rules that apply universally, but the general will doesn't handle day-to-day legislation and executive policy. So the government, in the sense we have it, to say we talk about the U.S. government or government of countries, what handles day-to-day affairs in a state, isn't the general will. It's the general will chooses particular people to form the government, and they don't have to choose a democracy, according to Rousseau. In fact, he thought that for large democracy could only work for a very small society. In larger societies, he thought the best type of government was an elective aristocracy. A hereditary aristocracy wasn't very good. That would be one of the worst. But the best would really be an elective aristocracy. Then he has a rather hard to understand mathematical formulas for just how big the government should be, how many people should be in it. He thinks, on the one hand, if you have a large society, then if you have the government is too small, then it won't be able to control the large society. You just have too many few people. They won't be able to handle, they have this problem, day-to-day administration of justice, for example. They won't be able to administer justice if there's a whole lot of people and just a few people in the government. So you need a larger government if there are more people in the society. So you have a larger number of people in the form the general will, have a larger government. On the other hand, if you have too large a government, that tends to be inefficient. Say if you have a monarch, there's just one person, he decides on the policy, so that's much more efficient than if you have to get a whole lot of people to agree on things. Remember, this is unlike the general will. This is day-to-day policy. So Rousseau arrives at the result that the size of the government should be the square root of the number of people in the society. I can't say I understand how he arrives at that result, but that's what he says. Now, we have a further addition. There's a further point that's a very important point in the political theory is we have the general will, and it's supposed to be voting on what's the general laws that are in everybody's interest. And then what it arrives at will be turn out to be what everybody really wants. So you'll be forced to be free even if you voted the other way. But we now have a question, well, how do we know, how do the people know which general laws to vote on? They could, if Rousseau is right, whatever way they vote will be give the general will, but that doesn't give them the agenda to vote. How will they know what are the general laws they're supposed to think about? Here, Rousseau brings in the figure of the legislator. And this is not someone who's in the government. This is an outside person, sometimes from outside the society, who Rousseau considers a genius, someone who attracts people to him by his powers of persuasion, and he's able to propose to people without forcing them the proper laws that they should pass. And Rousseau has in mind people like Kurgis, who was one of the considered founder of Sparta, and Moses, who had legislation, who proposed the legislation for the people of Israel. Of course, they did have political authority also, but in Rousseau's legislator wouldn't. He would just be someone who would be relying on his powers of persuasion. He would be superior to everyone else in his intellect, and people would look up to him. I suspect that Rousseau thought his own books would act in that way on other people, and he hoped that other people would learn from his books and put him in the position of treat him as if he were the legislator, even if not in person, just by following what he said in his writings. In order to have a general will of a kind, Rousseau wanted, you would need a fairly small society. As I said, Rousseau had views on how the government should vary in terms of, in relation to how many people in the society, but within those limits didn't go all that far. Once you had more than a certain number of people, Rousseau doesn't specify exact limits, but once you had more than a certain number of people, you really couldn't get, it'd be very unlikely you'd get the required consensus that would be needed for general will. So Rousseau wanted a fairly small society. And in fact, you could see throughout his work, he really looked back to the Greek city-states. To a large extent, he was a disciple of Plato, although one who much more stressed the emotions than Plato did. Plato, remember, wanted rule by the guardians who, in the ideal city, who represented, who were philosophers, whereas Rousseau stressed more the role of emotion. But still, you have the small city, really, city-state is the ideal. I think Hannah Arendt is supposed to have said that Rousseau suffered from polis envy. Additionally, one of the things that would, in order to secure the required unity and proper morals and manners among the people, education would be have to be very carefully regulated. And like Plato in both the ideal city of the Republic, Kallipolis, and the ideal city, the best city of the laws, Magnesia, like Plato, Rousseau favored censorship. There was a letter he wrote to D'Alembert, one of the figures of the French Enlightenment, which he very much defends censorship in Geneva. He said, people are having too many stage plays. These are very bad. It's better to have not stage plays, but festivals in which people participate themselves. And furthermore, it's very important to regulate the music that people listen to, because if they listen to the wrong kind of music, this can get people very upset, and then they won't be in the right frame of mind for proper politics. The writer Alan Bloom, who was a follower of Strauss, was also very devoted to Rousseau, continues this theme in his famous attack on current American education, the closing of the American mind. He devotes a great deal of attention to what he considers the dangers of rock music, how this has corrupted youth. And you know, people wondered when they read this, if he doesn't like this kind of music, why is he getting so upset about it? Why is it such a big deal? And you see, in doing this, he's following very much in Rousseau's footsteps. This is a very Rousseauian theme. The music that people listen to is really helping to determine their life. The music is one of the keys to Rousseau's thought. And Rousseau he thought that contemporary French music was too corrupt, it was too artificial, and he wrote attacks on it, and he defended Italian music and opera as much better because this was closer to, it wasn't as hyper-refined, it was much better. This got him into a lot of trouble with the French musicians at the time and kind of prevented him from being as successful in his musical work as he could have, as he might have been otherwise. As you see, the society Rousseau depicted in The Social Contract is one that isn't very friendly to liberty. It's one where there's kind of a forced unity, and then we say that people are really free because they're doing what, according to him, they really want to be. There's an additional aspect to Rousseau's work that's also covered in The Social Contract, and this is his chapter on civil religion. As we've seen in previous lectures, religion is a very key theme in the political philosophers. What is the proper role of religion in society? Now, Rousseau, as he does for the origins of society, goes through different theories, ones that he rejects, different views that he rejects before giving his own view. Now, he first says, in the ancient world, the gods were very closely tied to the city. Each city really had its own gods. You would find, say, among the Greeks, the gods were really the same on different cities, but there'd be minor variations. So each city would have its own special deity to which it would be devoted. There was a great famous book later in the 19th century by the historian Fustel de Coulanges develops this, very much defends it, sort of showing how the ancient city was tied to the gods in a very close way. Now, Rousseau, you might think, from what I've said about his wanting to go back to the ancient Greeks, you might think he would endorse this, but he doesn't. He said, well, you know, we can't accept this because, after all, this polytheistic view isn't true. There aren't these separate gods for this each city, so we have to reject that. Then the second view he considers is kind of a mild form of Christianity, one that doesn't have very strict dogmas. It somehow you have a view where you believe in universal brotherhood and you think Jesus was kind of the supreme person, but you're not really committed to any theological dogmas. And Rousseau doesn't like this view very much either. And he says, what's wrong with this is that it separates people's religious views from their political life. People just think politics is just one sphere of life, and they have a higher allegiance, namely, to religion. And this also could lead to people not being wholehearted if, say, there's a war between one state and another, and people who hold this religious view might not be willing to fight. They might have the bad view that there's some humanity among the enemies, and we wouldn't want that to happen. That would be really bad. Now, in holding these views, Rousseau is clearly influenced by Machiavelli, who in the Discourses on Livy has this same view. So what Rousseau proposes instead of saying that this sort of mild version of Christianity or having separate gods in the city, he says what we have instead, we have a religion consisting of a few articles that everyone has to believe in. And one is that there's a God who's the creator of the world. Second, that people have immortal souls and there's rewards and punishments after death. Remember, this is quite similar to one of Locke's arguments. Locke says morality is dependent in this way, on this belief, and Rousseau has this also. So he says, also people within who hold to those are free then to hold a particular, more detailed religious views of their own, so long as they're tolerant of others, of other religions. You couldn't have, say, if a religion says that you can only achieve salvation by joining that church, then that isn't allowed because that would contribute to disunity in the state. You could only have religions that accepted the fundamental articles, including being tolerant of others. Now, what happens if you say someone doesn't agree with that? Or, then he could be admonished, but if he said, all right, he did agree, but then acted against that, then Rousseau holds he could be put to death. Have to really accept these articles of civil religion, it's determined that you don't, then you'd be executed. You remember where this proposal comes from. It's similar to Plato's Laws with the Nocturnal Council. Remember in that book, there's also a civil theology of quite similar kind. So I think here again, Rousseau is showing a strong Platonic influence. What Rousseau has come up with is really, when he talks about people being free, it's really an attempt somehow to reconstruct a version of Platonic politics, and people would be free only in a very unusual sense of the term. One thing also I should mention on Rousseau's system, given the views I mentioned he had on property, one wouldn't expect that property would fare very well, individual property would fare very well in the state that described in the social contract, and indeed it doesn't. And sometimes in Rousseau's work, he's more favorable to private property. For example, in an article he wrote for the Encyclopedia, a great multi-volume work of the French Enlightenment, he wrote the article on political economy for them. And here he's fairly sympathetic to private property. At other times he's very much opposed. For example, he wrote suggestion considerations for the government of Corsica. The Corsican authorities made the mistake of asking him for proposals on how they could write a constitution. He had some suggestions. Here he suggests maybe it would be better to do away with private property altogether and have everything in common. So what his usual position when he has a social contract is you would have some individual property, but you couldn't have very large inequalities because this would interfere with the formation of the general will. So individual property would be quite limited. And again, this is a theme found in Plato's Laws and also in the Republic. So in conclusion, then, I don't think Rousseau can be really put in the classical liberal libertarian tradition. Questions? Matthew.
Comments, maybe. First, I want to say I think that your presentation was very, very devastating critique of Rousseau. for his authoritarian attributes, which are many. Some I hadn't thought of, which I thought, I think he was very judicious in putting them forward. But I think leaving out certain aspects of Rousseau, or certain interpretations, makes it easier to say that there's no libertarian aspects to Rousseau at all. And hopefully everybody listening to your presentation, they're clear on the authoritarian aspects, which I agree with, and I see the Platonic side that you spoke about. I just would like to remind that Rousseau, he makes a devastating critique of representative government. That is, my understanding of the concept of the social contract is that it's not a state, but it's a plan to found a polity based on associational life. And the reason why it might be a path to a greater freedom, or at least, and I agree with your comment, equal to the freedom that people previously had before, is because he sees himself as hopefully increasing a more direct participation in government as distinct from representative government. Now, he has all these ideas about consciousness and everything that makes it seem like he's concerned that maybe people can't govern themselves, and he has this idea about civil religion and all that. But what I understand he's saying about the theater, besides censorship, is that when people get emotionally excited about observing cultural representation, and they're moved emotionally by a drama, say, that talks about people's self-governing capacities, he says, no. Just because they're emotionally excited and you see an action film or you see a great drama, they're seeing politics or government as outside themselves. And so his critique, as I understand it in the letter to D. Lambert, is that the problem with popular culture, it doesn't have to be rock and roll music, like Bloom says, is that people see what you say, the division of labor, that reinforces the idea of representative government. And the division of labor, what's bad about it, is it creates a state and civil society dichotomy where citizenship is thought to be separate from state power. And I think he's a critic of that. And so the idea of the social contract, if we don't see it as a state and we see it as a project of an enhanced associational life, it's still flawed. But it could have a certain libertarian aspect. And certain scholars, like, who I'm sure you're familiar with, like Robert Paul Wolff and C.L.R. James, have seen Rousseau in a more anarchistic light, which doesn't mean that they haven't missed all the things you're speaking of, which was very important. So I don't know if you could usually repeat the question, it's not a question, comment. You might want to speak on that a little bit.
Well, thank you. That was, if I may say, an excellent comment. The gist of it, as I understand it, was that in my talk, I stressed the authoritarian aspects of Rousseau, but there are also libertarian aspects, or at least aspects of Rousseau that are more, in which he's more in sympathy with libertarianism. Specifically, that Rousseau is a critic of representation, both in the theater and in government. He wants to stress the value of popular participation, say, in the government, instead of saying letting our representatives do everything for us, or viewing action movies or listening to music. We're involved ourselves in various associations, and it's further suggested that there are scholars such as Robert Paul Wolff and C.L.R. James who've written on this theme. I think there's certainly a measure of truth to that. I did mention that Rousseau criticizes people going to the theater instead of participating in the festivals themselves. And you're certainly right that Rousseau wanted to limit the authority of the government. You know, the reps would be not ourselves, would be the ones who were handling the day-to-day administration, as against the general will. But I think the popular participation, remember, is people getting all together and voting for general policy. So I don't think it gives adequate stress to the individual liberties. This was a theme that the great 19th century classical liberal Benjamin Constant had in his where he distinguished liberty of the ancients and modern, sort of the ancient liberty would be stressing this kind of popular participation. But Constant didn't reject that altogether, but he pointed out the need for more emphasis on individual liberty. And I would just say, since you mentioned Barbara Wolfe, I think Robert Paul, this isn't really directly on Rousseau, but one book I think everyone should read, is a very good book on political philosophy, is the one by Robert Paul Wolfe called In Defense of Anarchy. I'll just put that down. I should say also, if you look at Rousseau's last work, The Reveries of a Solitary Walker, it appears he isn't altogether satisfied with the position he took in the social contract, because here he seems to stress not political participation, but just his own grasp of what the sentiment of existence, sort of an individual, quite individual thing. He's in touch with himself. He seems there to be stressing that as a kind of a, the most important thing, that he has grasped his own sentiment or feeling of existence. He really, I don't think he really had a statement set up as the one he describes in The Social Contract. I don't think he would have really fitted in very well in it. Rodney.
Here's a suggestion as to how Rousseau gets to the general well. I think he starts off with a good idea, which is that he's uncomfortable about the idea in other social contract theorists about alienating our liberty, whether they're alienating all of it as if robbed, or even some of it as if locked, alienating to someone else. And you know, as long as you can alienate any part of your liberty to someone else, then you're not free. So then he thinks, well, I think where the community comes in is he thinks, if I just all by myself alienate my liberty to the community and no one else does, well, then I'm not free, I'm a slave of the community. But if all the members of the community alienate their liberty, give all complete authority over themselves to the community, then there's no longer distinction between the ruler and the ruled, because it's the community as a whole that has taken authority over all the individual groups. And so somehow, this doesn't work, but I think this is an idea that way you haven't really lost any freedom, because there's no real distinction between the giver of the liberty and the receiver of it, because all the people are giving it to this sort of collective body. And then they've agreed to whatever is in the interest of that collective body. And that's why it can't just be the majority will, but it has to be something that's the will of the entire collective.
The suggestion was that perhaps we can take Rousseau's argument in this way. Say, how could he have thought that people are still free if they, with given his view of general will, is that instead of each person hasn't alienated his liberty to any particular person, but you take, say, if you take a person who's alienated his liberty to the general, to the whole community. Now, if one person would do that and nobody else did, then he wouldn't be free. But if you imagine everybody doing that, so say everyone has alienated his liberty to the whole community, then maybe Rousseau thought somehow people were still free, because there'd be no real distinction between the individuals and the collective body. So I think that is it. I think probably what he meant, and I think the problem there is, as I tried to bring out in the lecture, is that he's left with the fact that even if there is this kind of unification taking place in some sense, even if he's right about that, you still haven't gotten rid of the individual will, sort of the down-to-earth individual, and that will can still be very much in conflict with what the general will wants. So even if Rousseau is right, he's still wrong. So there's a very good book on Rousseau by David Gautier, where he brings out this point that Rousseau really wasn't able to come up with a sense of freedom that fully satisfied himself, even his own standards. Anybody else? Yeah.
As between Hobbes and Locke and Rousseau, mm-hmm. whether you like Hobbes and his program, seems fairly consistent. Mm-hmm. Whether you like Locke or not, it seems fairly consistent. Mm-hmm.
Rousseau seems so, maybe this is just to me, incoherent. Why is he so well thought of today, especially by people who aren't necessarily in this room? He must be a hero for some reason, and I find him completely incoherent.
Well, the question was, it seems, regardless of how you feel about Hobbes or Locke, that they were, you could at least see they take very consistent positions, but it seems that Rousseau isn't consistent. In fact, it was suggested he's incoherent. So why is it that Rousseau's viewed as an important thinker? What is this? What's the big deal about Rousseau? Well, I think, there are a couple things. One is he's, although he certainly has positions that don't fit well with each other, he has interesting arguments. I mean, if you look, say, at the way at social contract, you see, he was certainly no dummy. He had very carefully worked out arguments. Some of them, they don't always fit with each other. They are interesting, and they've been extremely influential. In the French Revolution, later writers have looked him. I think one reason he's in, you ask why he's influential with people outside this room, especially, well, he really formulated some of the key arguments that critics of capitalism have used, sort of that division of labor alienates people from themselves, or that people are not really free if they're dependent on others in the market. He also had a major influence on the moral philosophy of Immanuel Kant, who thought extremely highly of him. And I suppose one reason, if you could ask your same, if you want to ask the same question about Kant, I don't know that you would, but if you take Kant as an important thinker, you would have a good reason to take Rousseau as important also. Well, I think we're out of time now, so thanks very much.